This is a production from the Yak Podcasting Network. The home for your growing sonic map of local voices united in their commitment to the best in podcasting.
And now, a yak.
Yak!
Welcome, everybody, to a special edition of a new podcast that we are launching on the Yak. We're calling it Pigskin Plinko, in honor of everybody's favorite game on The Price is Right back in the day. Here's how it works. There's four of us on the podcast today. Myself, Jeff Ketchum, Jason Sukumel, Bo Edge, who will be launching a new show, several new shows, actually, here on the Yak. But the return of the Nooner is coming back with Bo Edge and Chance Mock and Shady Lewis. It will be one of the new content distributors that we'll be adding to the network in the coming weeks and months. Bo will actually, they'll be getting going actually fairly soon. And a special guest on the podcast today. We want to be doing this a little more regularly, bringing in members of the Orange Bloods community to participate in our podcasts. Today, the infamous Drunk Randok joins the podcast. Drunk, I won't say your name if you don't want me to, right? I don't necessarily want your personal information getting out. I've never dealt with this before with the guests where I've called you by Drunk Randok. Are you okay with that? Or we just call you Drunk?
That's fine. Whatever you want to do is fine with me.
So here's how it works. I put together a series of questions. All of them are football topics. I gave everybody on Orange Bloods a chance to vote for the topic they would like for us to discuss the most. The first one is a UT football topic. The categories were Todd Orlando and the defense's performance this season, the future of the Texas front seven / front six after this season, Tom Herman's single best decision as a head coach, Tom Herman's single worst decision as a head coach. The Herman's best and worst decisions got none of the votes, basically. It basically came down to a vote between discussions of Todd Orlando and the future of the Texas front seven, front six. And by a very healthy margin, 53% of the votes focused towards the future of the Texas front seven / front six going into next season. It's an interesting conversation. Jason, I'll start with you. If you look at whatever it is that we think about this defense after this year, they lose essentially all their starters. You're going to say goodbye to Charles Amenihu. You're going to say goodbye to Chris Nelson. You're going to say goodbye to Brecken Hager and Gary Johnson and Anthony Wheeler. I tend to give the linebacker position the benefit of the doubt that it's going to be okay. I don't worry so much about who is going to replace Wheeler and Johnson. But that defensive line, we've been talking about the lack of impact recruits for a while. I wonder if it hasn't started to catch up to the team this year and what it means next year when the three players that they're counting on this season for almost all of its production are no longer there.
Well, losing your production is the scary part. And first off, apologies, Drunk Randok. If they say drunk and I hop in, I'll be drunk too. You're drunk one. I'll be drunk too. How about that? Losing your starters is certainly a bit alarming. But if you're projecting forward, you got to remember you're going to have Malcolm Roach back. He can play linebacker. I think he's still better suited. Maybe put him on the line, let him pin his ears back and do some things. You'll have Gerald Wilbon back. Hasn't been an ultra productive player, but he's serviceable. Taquan Graham, Bimage have played. And you've got some good young players there, including in the middle. I mean, my biggest concern, if I'm looking at that, is in the middle with Jared Wilbon. He's been serviceable. He's made some plays here or there, but is he a guy you can count on week in and week out to anchor that defense from the nose tackle spot? I don't know. Texas had a luxury with Puna Ford last year. Chris Nelson's done pretty well this year. To me, man, it all starts in the middle. But, yeah, that's a bit alarming. But you have a couple, remember, really good true freshmen that haven't played this year. Keandre Coburn, highly sought-after recruit, one of the top defensive tackle prospects in the country. You talk about a big guy that can, anchor the middle. He's 320 pounds. I'm not sure what he is right now, but young man with a lot of potential. Moro Ojomo, the defensive lineman, and this guy can be a swing type, you know, defensive end or defensive tackle out of Katy, who, Ketch, you've heard me talk about him personally. I'm really high. I thought he might be the sleeper of the 2018 recruiting class Texas signed. So you never want to have to replace three starters across the board up front. That's never ideal. But I do think they've got some young talent, but the problem is it's unproven. So there's a, you know, high risk, high reward potential there. I kind of do agree with you, though, at linebacker, a little less worrisome, maybe, if you will. You know, I think Jeffrey McCulloch still, you know, he'll be back next year. I still think he has a lot of potential.
If we had never known that guy as a recruit, would we still be saying that about Jeffrey McCulloch?
You know, it hasn't happened as much this year. We've seen him flash some this year, but not a ton. But last year, and even as a freshman, it seemed like to me like when they put him on the field, he was productive. I mean, I would love to see what he can do as a full-time starter, and we'll probably get our chance next year. But again, I mean, you're right. We're talking unproven assets here to some degree, but I like McCulloch's potential. You've heard good things about Joseph Osai behind the scenes. You know, middle linebacker, everybody talks about Dele Adoye. To me, that's a bit of a wild card because he hasn't played. He certainly hasn't been good enough in practice to come in and play as a freshman. So I know they talk a lot about him. They're high on him, but, you know, I don't know. If he hasn't been on the field yet this year, that makes me wonder if he's not a step or two behind where most people thought he would. Losing Gary Johnson's obviously huge, but, you know, DeMarvion Overshone's got talent. They're chasing that JUCO linebacker, Caleb Johnson, to kind of step in maybe and fill Gary Johnson's shoes. So, you know, a lot of young talent, but it is a sizable gap. You're going from seniors to a lot of times freshmen or redshirt freshmen. So it is worrisome. There's going to be some hiccups, obviously, but I think the talent's there. They just have to get those guys up to speed. And that's the real challenge for Oscar Giles and Todd Orlando.
Yes.
I was going to say, on your point on McCulloch, though, there is something, or there's a lot to be said when a guy doesn't have a home. And McCulloch's been bounced around from different linebacker position to different linebacker position. Next year, starting in the work that they do all through spring and through summer, if they pencil him in that spot and they put him in that Wheeler spot and they say, it's your spot, go earn it, all of a sudden that guy gets confidence. That guy plays better. I think the same thing will happen with Malcolm Roach. If they decide that he's going to be on the line, then he plays that the whole time. It's not bouncing around between middle linebacker when somebody's hurt and this and that. And they're seniors. They know that they only have one last shot to get to the league. They didn't come here not to go to the league. So I think finding a permanent home and writing their name on the wall might bring out the best in a couple of those guys.
That's fair. And I think, you know, we were seeing it in Charles Omenihue this season, that there is something to be said for a guy being a senior, his fourth year in a program. Throwing it to Drunk Randoke on this, is there anything, which of these guys do you think is the hardest to replace going into next season? Is there a guy that we're talking about that when you look ahead to next season, you worry about the most, filling that production and or just quality of play with what's behind him?
I think for me, it's Gary Johnson. I just think he's had a lot of production this year, and I just don't know who's going to step into that role. And on another note, I just, myself, just more as a fan, I just thought we would have seen Coburn a little this year. And I know there were some reports that he came in a little heavy, but I was a little surprised that the guy hasn't played at all this year, but I still think he's a guy they're going to have to count on a lot next year.
No, it's a really good point. And, you know, it's interesting because I don't know about the rest of you. I've talked about this season as a stepping stone for what I think could be possible in year three. I think about Ellinger going into his junior year and the players that they'll have coming back. You think about all the young guys from that last, really the last two recruiting classes. I mean, last year's had a lot of star power, but I think we'll look back on that 2017 class. I think we already do and realize that they did a really good job of evaluation, getting guys like Sam Cosmi, a number of players in that class who've already made contributions. I worry, you know, I think I would be most concerned about the defensive ends because Marquez Bemidji and Taquan Graham have been non-factors, despite the fact that they've you know, you take away the Marquez Bemidji play in the TCU game where he stripped Sean Robinson, which is a monster play. It may actually be as big a play as any that's happened in the season so far. But in the other seven games, he hasn't made any plays. Taquan Graham hasn't really made any plays. I look at Malcolm Roach and I see a guy, they moved him to linebacker because in this Todd Orlando scheme, he struggled with his hand on the ground. So next season, I think he's not going to play linebacker. I think they're going to put him back. They're going to put his hand on the ground, but that hasn't been, and I'm as big of a Malcolm. I thought last year he would compete for Big 12 Defensive Player of the Year honors. I couldn't have been more wrong. I think his upside's really high, but I do worry the defensive end position has been a problem this year. And that's with Charles Omenihu playing at a really high level. I think for me, replacing Omenihu is the big one because I don't know exactly who that is. They need two or three guys to step up. And I don't know if it's more I don't know how realistic it is to expect that all of those guys will be able to ramp up their level of play to A, get to the level that they're at this season, which hasn't been good enough. And then B, take it beyond that and really make that position across the board a strength. I wonder if you can truly compete at a national level if the front part of your defense isn't a true strong suit. So I think there's a lot of ground that has to be made up. And I think you'll look at Yancey McKnight and I think you'll look at those position coaches and say, this is the year more than any other. You've truly got to make your money because I think last year, you'd look at it and you go, okay, I think Chris Nelson's going to be okay. And had Omenihu coming back. And even though Malik Jefferson left, nobody stressed out over that because they saw the way Gary Johnson played towards the end of the season. I can't remember if it was Bo or Drunk Randoke that made the comment, but, you know, just not having – there's just been so little production behind all of those guys that it's hard to know exactly who's going to fill that role, whereas a season ago – there were a number of guys that even when a guy like Puna Ford was leaving, you knew that Chris Nelson had done a better job than I think what we've seen from Gerald Wilbon at this point, which I think made us more comfortable with all of those guys.
Well, and Jeff, and that's why I would say the biggest loss potentially is going to be Chris Nelson, because all those other positions, you have guys that you have at least a thought that they can fill in that role. Whatever you want to say about Hager's performance this year, I think whoever takes that job won't do worse. I think that the young guys in Graham and Bemidji may be able to step up. I think the linebackers have the potential to step up. We have no idea what's going to replace Nelson. And for whatever you don't think he has served a very adequate role in spots. Not every game and not every quarter, but there have been moments like the second half of the Oklahoma State game where Nelson just exerted his will on the line. And if you look at the schedule, what's the big thing coming right down the pipe? LSU, what do they like to do? They like to hammer you up the middle. If Wilbon doesn't make that Puna Ford, Chris Nelson jump in his senior year, what's there? It's going to be a gaping hole that LSU will exploit the entire day.
But for Wilbon's sake, that's maybe the thing he does well is just kind of clog up and take free up your linebackers.
That's assuming he's on the field with his health.
But you got to remember, I mean, you know, this staff, I think if we could all probably agree, I don't want to speak for everybody, but I mean, their evaluations have been pretty on point. I trust their evaluations probably as much as or more certainly than the previous staff. You know, I mean, Keandre Coburn was a nationally ranked talent. I mean, he's a guy, if he can't contribute, you know, that's a swing and a miss by not just Texas because everybody wanted that young man. You know, Moro Ojomo, I talked about, he can play inside, he can play outside. I tell you, a wild card we haven't talked about, defensive line prospect, he's a redshirt freshman this year, Mike Williams, a young man out of Louisiana they took, just kind of a big wrecking ball. Yeah. And this is a young man who played quarterback. And if you remember his highlight film, he's bouncing off of about 10 tacklers on an 80-yard touchdown, but, you know, kind of a Malcolm Roach type. So they've got some moving parts there, I think, that they can move guys around. But, you know, to your point, Bo, it's like they're all inexperienced. You don't know what you're going to get from Wilbon if he is, if it's put on his shoulders to take a bigger role. You don't know, obviously, if Coburn's going to live up to those expectations. So, it is a concern, but there are enough parts there. I think you can feel somewhat confident that they'll find the right pieces.
Should we expect to see Coburn a little in the last four games? Or are they just going to completely park that guy this year? And
that's
if they don't play
question.
Him at all, what does that mean? What does that mean? I mean, you'd like to see him at least get a few snaps when it's not really going to count against them, but I'm just really surprised he hasn't played at all.
Me too.
I'm with you, at this point,
doesn't it have to happen against Kansas, though? You're not going to do it against West Virginia. You're not going to do it in Lubbock. Probably not Iowa State. I mean, doesn't it have to, you know, if you get up on Kansas, and who's to say that's going to happen, but it's, you know, if they get up on 21 points in Kansas, do you throw out a lot of these troops? And Daniel Carson, we haven't talked about Daniel Carson, a highly sought after, kind of a strong side defensive end type from last year's class as well. So, you know, I've thought the same thing all year. I mean, at what point do you get some of those guys some reps? But the problem is Texas has found itself in such competitive ball games from week to week. There just hasn't been really a chance to get those guys much work.
It does make Oscar Giles the most important coach on the staff next year, doesn't it? Because he's got to coach all of that. He's got to, all of his guys have to, you know, he's critical.
His development of his players is critical, and his recruitment, you know, he closed strongly last year, but listen, man, if we're talking about the class that he's signing in 2019, I mean, there's a lot of work to be done there. So yeah, he's critical, but for being completely honest, he needs to,
I'm just talking about development though. Yeah, like, well, I feel you, but I'm
even
just
on development, I mean, listen, I mean, his defensive line this year hasn't been dominant. So, if you're calling him the most critical coach, you're going to have a lot of fans that are hitting the panic button, man. So,
well, I'm just saying, like, all of his guys are turning over. So he's replaced. He's got a lot of, you were talking about those freshmen. Like, they got to get those guys ready to play, because Bo makes a great point. That LSU game is coming, man. And Texas is either prepared up front physically for it, or we'll know what LSU will do. And that is their MO. Let's transition a little bit. We're going to go to topic number two. And I'm going to let Drunk Rando take the lead on this one, because he's a man of the people, and the people spoke very loudly on this topic that they want us to speak on. It was your favorite college football topic for this podcast. And the options were Urban Meyer, who, by the way, now has a cyst in his brain? It's just that so came out this week. That
it's
came
in
out
his soul, Jeff. The cyst is in his soul.
Yeah, but Urban Meyer didn't win, so let's not go down that rabbit hole, because we could. People could have voted for it, but they didn't. Kyler Murray and the Sooners probably would have been my favorite one to talk about, because I can't talk enough about Kyler Murray and the way I dislike him. Texas A&M season.
What I voted for.
I voted for Kyler Murray. But the winner with 68.6% of the vote, I mean, it was a landslide, Big 12 officials. So, Drunk Randoke, it was Oklahoma State week again this week, which is like an annual, it's like the final Grant Taft home game every year with Oklahoma State as it relates to the officiating. And it was terrible again this week. It's just it's always going to be terrible, isn't it?
It seems like it, and especially with Oklahoma State and this trend of our head coach getting a penalty in a game, which is unusual. But I read a post the other day, which is true, which you hear about this a lot more after a loss than you do with a win. So while I think there still would have been a lot of complaining if we had squeaked out a win Saturday, I don't think you would hear as much. But yeah, it's just, it's really ugly. And as someone who goes to a lot of the games and sits in the stands, it's just, you just have no idea what's going to happen play to play. And I just, I don't know if this is a Big 12 thing. I don't really watch a lot of the conferences. I don't know what the fans and writers for other conferences are seeing, but it just seems really ugly.
Well, Drunk, and I call you Drunk being one myself in some ways. I think the poor officiating translates to the spread offenses in some ways, because you look at where the two worst rated officials crews are at. It's the Big 12 and the Pac-12. Washington State is going to end up missing the national championship because of an egregious no call on a late hit on the quarterback that cost Washington State a chance at an undefeated season. The same thing happens in the Big 12 every year. I think part of it is it's easier to officiate some of the offensive production in some of these other leagues. You go to the Big 10 or the SEC, or in some cases the ACC, they're not looking for the same things. And most of the missed calls involve receivers and motion and things of that nature. Just like on the you know, there was a big debate on Orange Bowl that I saw about whether the tight end was ineligible on the touchdown play by Oklahoma State. Well, obviously smart coaches are going to take advantage of the fact that the refs just can't see everything. And these aren't NFL caliber refs, and that's a different conversation. This is the best of what they can find, but people are going to miss things. when guys like Dabo Swinney says he ran a pick play to win the national championship because he knew the Big 12 officials weren't going to call it, that's problematic. But it's also indicative of what you're getting game in, game out. People complain about it. I complain about it. But it ends up balancing out in some ways because you end up getting some calls too. Texas fans forget that. Texas fans forget that occasionally they get a goodie call too that kind of goes their way, that they just say, yeah, it's about time we got one of those. Well, yeah, but then you're still unhappy when you got one that went the other way.
Well, and Bo, to your point, Saturday, Texas had a holding penalty in the end zone.
Thank you.
And somehow the officials came away from that, giving the penalty the wrong player and not acknowledging that the hold actually occurred about 3 yards deep into the end zone. Like, it should have been a safety. So I thought one of the real important things about Saturday was I didn't feel like any one team got screwed. I feel like
they both got screwed
multiple times in the game. And are we too hard on officials? Is this just because I've never officiated a game? I think Bo makes a good point that in a passing league, I think the hardest calls to sometimes make are the pass interference calls.
Remember, Texas got a break, but they got a questionable pass interference call late in that Oklahoma game that helped Texas ultimately win that game. Man, this is going to piss off a lot of our listeners. I get so tired of the bitching and moaning about officiating. Yeah, they screw up, but it's a tough job. But the fix is in. Bullshit. I mean, come on, guys. It's not. Like someone said, you think the Big 12 really wants to keep Texas out of the Big 12 championship game and they really want to aid Oklahoma State? That's ridiculous, man. There were bad calls. There always are. Now, if the topic is Big 12 officiating poor? Absolutely. And I think Bo makes a great point that, frankly, I've never really processed much. But you think about just all the movement and just the spacing. It is probably a lot tougher to officiate in this conference than most others. But is officiating in the Big 12 poor? Absolutely. Is it one-sided against Texas? No, and I hate that argument. It comes up every single week as soon as there's a questionable call. But you know what? Go to any other board. Go to Alabama or Texas A&M or Oklahoma. It's the same thing, but I just get sick of it every week whining and complaining about the bad calls. Listen, take care of your business, Texas, last week. Don't start off, crapping the bed in the first quarter. And some of those calls don't matter. And Catch, you mentioned it. Texas got a couple calls, big calls of their own that saved them a little bit. So, it's poor officiating in the conference, but you got to deal with it. You got to just move on and quit making it an excuse. I'm sick of it.
I think there's also.
Go ahead, Bo.
Oh, sorry, Jeff. I was going to say, I think there's proof that some of the Big 12 officials read Alex's column on a regular basis, because the only reason they called that on Vae is because they're just used to seeing Alex rip on Vae. So when they knew there was a hole, that's how they messed it up. They just said, it's automatically got to go to the default.
Well, he's laying on the ground. Surely he must have held somebody. He's just laying on the ground by himself. So, yeah.
I think my biggest thing that annoys me the most is if when I'm watching a high school game or a youth league game, and I haven't yet started to watch a lot of youth league games, but in general, like I have a lot of compassion for the regular Joe who is trying to, he's just trying to help. He's getting paid $50 to go out there and do this, and he's getting yelled at, and it's probably not worth it, but he needs it for rent. Like, I get it. But the college officials, I don't understand how a billion-dollar industry doesn't in unison have full-time officials who make their product better. And I think the thing that annoys me is these guys fly in and they're lawyers and they're not doctors, probably, but maybe some of them are doctors and they're professionals who show up on the weekends. They fly in from wherever they're coming from. It's not their full-time gig. And I think it shows. And I think that, I think that all of the leagues could make a greater commitment to having better officiating, because I think the one thing, I think it was Bo that mentioned the Pac-12, they do have awful officiating. But if you go, but Jason's also right, if you go to the Alabama board and they're smoking people by 40, they're still talking about bad officiating. I feel like bad officiating exists everywhere in college football. And it's rare when I feel like I get through a game and I go, you know what? The officials did a good job of letting them play and they got the big moments right. And it's the reason why I love instant replay, even though they screw that up sometimes, because at least there's an insurance against truly egregious calls when there can be. But these judgment calls like pass interference and some of these other ones, I just feel like these games are in the hands of amateurs, and they are. They're in the hands of amateurs. And while you don't see it as much in the NFL, you don't. Like, if there's a bad mistake in the NFL, they'll talk about that thing all weekend. It will be the number one lead on a Monday show is the bad call in an NFL game. But more times than not, the overwhelming majority of the games, those games go off without the officiating usually being talked about. So I think that the thing is, how do you make it better? And I think it has to come from the league. I think someone like Chris Del Conte needs to take the lead and say the officiating in the Big 12 needs to be better. There's no reason why we shouldn't invest in this. I don't, you know, if it means that you have to add an extra $500,000 a year to have really well officiated games, I don't know. In a $1 billion a year industry, I don't know why protecting yourself and the quality and the, you know, the sanctity, if you will, of the results, I think you need to do something. Moving along, this was our NFL related topic. The question, and there was, I could have gone with any of these and I'd have been down. The topics were the Amari Cooper trade with the Cowboys and the Raiders, the Demaryius Thomas trade with the Texans yesterday, Texas and the NFL Hall of Fame, and Jason Garrett. And it was close. It was competitive. But with nearly 40% of the vote, UT and the NFL Hall of Fame was selected. And I guess in my head, when I thought about that as a topic, I wondered, A, who each of us would select to be in the Hall of Fame that isn't, if we were to pick a Longhorn and say that guy is going to be in the NFL. And at the same time, I thought it would be make for a good conversation to talk about Longhorns who down the road will have a chance to be in the NFL Hall of Fame. Jason, I'll start with you. I think I know what your answer is going to be. If you could pick one Longhorn who isn't in the NFL Hall of Fame to be in the NFL Hall of Fame, who would you pick?
Current players included?
Sure. I won't close it down that way.
Okay. Easy choice for me is Justin Tucker. That guy's a no-brainer first ballot Hall of Famer. You know, as silly as it sounds to say it, after whatever it is, 9 weeks of football, you know, is Michael Dixon the guy that could be in that category 10 years, 15 years from now? Absolutely. But I think Justin Tucker, Earl Thomas are the two no-brainers, and it's a
– Is Tucker going to get in?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, man, he has to. Well, if he has the point total, I mean, you know, Vinatieri's going to get in because he's the leading scorer. But Tucker is the best kicker in the history of the NFL. If he has the longevity that I expect, and if he has the point total, yeah, I mean, I can't see him not getting in.
I've never thought about Justin Tucker as he's, I think, the most accurate kicker in the NFL history, either he or Dan Bailey. We know his stats. What do you think, Bo? What do you think, Drunk Rando? Is Tucker what does Tucker have to do? Does he have to play 20 years and have the Vinatieri career and the Morton Anderson longevity? That's he's going to have to play that long, isn't he?
He's going to have to play that long. He's going to have. And he's going to have to hit some of those highlight kicks that end up on SportsCenter so he gets more name recognition. He's getting there. People know who Justin Tucker is nationwide, not just in Longhorn land. But more of those 59-yarders with the dance afterwards. You know, he needs to – the Ravens have to win. Because for kickers to get credit, their teams have to win. There have to be kicks.
But he does
count.
Have a ring, and that helps.
He has one. But the reason Vinatieri gets so much love is because of the big kicks he made in clutch moments. He still gets credit for game-winning kicks in Super Bowls, for AFC Championship kicks. Tucker needs a couple more of those, and yes, I do think he gets in. And to answer the second part of your question, who's not in that I think should be in, even though he never will get in, for me it's one answer. It's Casey Hampton. Casey Hampton was a significant piece of teams that were very competitive for many years, and the only reason he's not going to be in is because the stat line doesn't match up because he played a position where there is no stats. It's a position that never gets credit, but without that position doing their job, nobody else can do theirs. You know, the great linebackers from Pittsburgh and the Woodsons and you know, Carnell Lakes, get credit because Casey Hampton did his job in that system. Without Casey Hampton taking a double every single time, those guys don't get their success.
Jason, you're the resident Steelers fan in this group. I was with you the day that we were at the sports bar near the bowling alley, the day that, you know, off I-35, the day that Casey Hampton was drafted, because I remember it's also the day that the Cowboys took Quincy Carter and passed over Drew Brees. Not that I, all these years later, I am bitter about that actually still.
Good for Drew.
Quincy Carter thing. But I remember going into the bathroom at the sports bar that we
were
at.
Not together. Clarify.
Not together. This story actually doesn't involve you and me in the bathroom. It involves another Steelers fan in the bathroom who was like, "Do you think that was a good pick?" And I just remember telling him, "Oh yeah, Casey Hampton, you guys are going to love that pick. He may be the best nose tackle of his era. He made Pro Bowls. He has Super Bowl rings." But Jason, as a Steelers fan, do you view in your mind Casey Hampton as an NFL Hall of Famer, amongst all of the players that'll be Hall of Famers and have been Hall of Famers in Steelers lore?
Well, you're asking the wrong guy. I mean, do I? Of course. I mean, listen.
Okay.
I'm a Steeler fan, but I think if you asked the average Steeler fan not in Austin, you know, he's not a guy. I mean, they remember Kevin Green and Greg Lloyd and Rod Woodson more than they do Casey, but some of that, like Bo said, is the position he played. It's not a stat compiling position, but you know, if you think back to when he played, if you were to ask the coaches and some of his teammates, I mean, they were on the record as saying, "Hey, he is the best player on that defense." So you can certainly make a strong ass case that he needs to be in there. But again, I'm the guy who wear my Casey Hampton jersey when I go see the Steelers game. So I'm probably the wrong guy to ask. I think I was
Casey
the only
will
guy
make it.
In the stadium that had a Casey Hampton jersey on for the AFC Championship game I saw. So I'm probably the wrong. I may be a little bit biased on that question.
Casey will make it, or the only way Casey will make it is if the veterans vote him in. Because if you go take a consensus of the centers and guards that he went up against for 10 years, they would all say Hall of Fame in a heartbeat. The problem is, like I said, it's not a glamour position. It's just like offensive line. Left tackles get in, centers don't. Yeah, I mean, unless you're just a flashy guy that gets a lot of pub or whatever, no, you don't see nose tackles on billboards. You don't see nose tackles in national TV campaigns. It's not a marquee position.
What about you, Drunk Rando? Who's your Longhorn that you want to put in the NFL Hall of Fame?
I would have to go with Casey. Well, I was a big fan of him. I was in school the same time he was. So yeah, I would have to go with him. One thing that surprised me, just jumping off a little, was the lack of Longhorns in the NFL Hall of Fame. There's only four. Those are Earl Campbell, Bobby Lane, and then Tom Landry and Tex Schramm, which those last two are obviously in there because they're Cowboys. And just looking at the school that have the most, Texas is nowhere near the top. And that really surprised me. I never thought about that.
I need to do my why haven't the Longhorns done more to celebrate Tom Landry as a presence in the Longhorn football program. Every two or three years, I go on a tangent about that and how Tom Landry's a big deal. He's like he's arguably on the Mount Rushmore of NFL head coaches. I mean, and you could walk down to UT and you can walk around every inch of that football facility and you would never know that Tom Landry was there. And yet Dallas Griffin's on the wall, right? I mean, no offense to Dallas Griffin and the award that he won, the national award that he won when he was a senior, that has allowed for him to have that presence. But, you know, maybe somewhere you have a hat and maybe, I don't know. Look, I would have a statue of Tom Landry up at the school. And if it was me, I would.
You'd have one at your house.
I would have their family all the time. I do have one at the house. I'm sitting next to it right now. I cannot. But Jason, I'm disappointed in you. Because I think you missed the answer. To me, the answer is Tommy Nobis. To me, Earl Thomas is going to get in. And Justin Tucker may very well get in.
Honestly, I forgot he wasn't in. Yeah.
But as a guy, you know it as well as I do. In part, like Tommy Novus was on the NFL team of the decade in the 60s. Like he was a great player on a terrible team. There just wasn't a better guy though than Tommy Novus. Anytime during the first, I don't know, it felt like every once in a while, Jason, we'd call Tommy Novus. We called him for the Swing for 44 event. We called him for some stories that we did over the years. And for a guy who was involved at high levels of an NFL franchise, he was so easy to get along with and so easy to get in touch with. Cool.
Yeah, just amazing. Yeah.
And he always wanted to talk about Texas. Like, he loved Texas. And even though he became kind of Mr. Atlanta Falcon, there's just no doubt in my mind that the University of Texas was kind of the apple of his eye. And there's just very many of these players who are on all decade teams that haven't made it into the NFL Hall of Fame. I have to believe at some point, and it's sad that it's going to occur after Tommy Novus has passed. I have to believe at some point the Veterans Committee, as they clean how we left off over the years, I have to believe that that wrong will be righted and that Tommy Novus will someday get in. I think Earl Thomas is in. He's the best player from the Legion of Boom ever. I don't think Jamal Charles is going to, and I think he was a few more peak seasons away. Probably the same with Priest Holmes. Both of those guys had dynamite NFL careers that just didn't have the longevity.
How close is Derek Johnson to getting in, you think? Does he have a chance?
No, because he's never been elite of the elite.
Yeah, not on.
He's in the Hall of Very Good at the NFL level.
Hey, Jeff, to mirror your thought on Novus, it's the same thing that's going to translate with the Derek Johnson, the Jamal Charles, and it goes back to the Augie Garrido quote, which I'll probably butcher, but the world treats winners differently.
Yeah.
And when you're on a perennial also-ran that's finishing dead last at a non-marquee position like middle linebacker, you just don't get the respect from the national media. It's the same thing that's going to hurt Derek Johnson, who you said he was really good. If he was the middle linebacker for the New England Patriots for the last 15 years, he'd be a surefire Hall of Famer. If he had four rings playing the middle position for that defense, he'd be in. You know, if Jamal Charles was the running back for the Green Bay Packers when Aaron Rodgers won a Super Bowl, he'd be in. They have no rings on their fingers, and their teams never were big, splashy teams, and you don't get the votes.
Kind of pisses me off that Derek Johnson isn't on this Chiefs team, that he was on so many average Chiefs teams, and now, because to me, the Chiefs are like the Rams from the late 90s. And I just love watching the Chiefs play football. They're fun. And he's never had that. He's never had Patrick Mahomes doing that thing. And if the Chiefs win a Super Bowl the year after Derek Johnson leaves the club, I think fate is a mother. All right. Our final topic of the day. And Jason, this one will be absolutely in your wheelhouse. We'll let you take the lead on this, although I'm curious if Drunk Randoke has somebody that he would poach among, you know, any candidates. Here we go. So the last topic is Texas football recruiting, it may have been the closest vote of them all. The categories were possible in-state recruiting flips, most likely All-American in the 2019 class for Texas, coaching hire that would most help recruiting, and A&M versus Texas in next year's recruiting. It was the closest vote of them all. I personally voted for coaching hire that would most help recruiting, but at 40.8% possible in-state recruiting flips. Jason, I feel like we've talked about this on the Ticket City podcasts. Okay, guys, our final topic is a recruiting topic, which means we'll probably let Jason set us up and then we'll all go on from there. Four categories. One was possible in-state recruiting flips, and it didn't specify towards Texas specifically, but I suppose it would. Most likely All-American for Texas in the 2019 recruiting class, coaching hire that would most help recruiting, and A&M versus Texas in 2020 recruiting. It was the closest vote amongst all of the categories because there were multiple choices that people liked as opposed to just two. I personally went with coaching hire that would most help recruiting, but it lost because 40.8% of the vote wanted to talk about possible in-state recruiting flips. Jason, I feel like we've talked about this quite a bit in the Ticket City locker rooms or the Ticket City podcast when we've gone over this. In your mind, it doesn't seem like a normal year when there are some obvious choices. Who are the guys that you are personally keeping an eye on?
Well, we've talked about in, I've done it in my Q&A. I remember, Ketch, you and I, the very first podcast we recorded, the Something's Brewing podcast for the Yak, you and I talked about this, and I said then, and you agreed, we said, I don't know that there are, we went down the LSR top 25 or whatever, and there really weren't any strong candidates. Everybody likes to joke about Texas A&M's decommit season. Well, things are a little different this year. I mean, A&M's played pretty well on the field, I think better than a lot of people expected. Jimbo's first year, he gets a bit of a pass there. So, I knew this question was coming, so I kind of made a list. There are some candidates, but it's not as sexy as we've seen in the past. I mean, it's not, certainly not Kyler Murray flipping or, these big time national prospects that I think are going to flip, but you've got a guy like, and I still classify this as a flip, but Kennedy Lewis, the wide receiver from Melissa, Texas, who was committed to TCU, Texas offers him, he decommits. He's still uncommitted right now. He's going to be in Austin this weekend. He's a candidate. Technically, I mean, is he flipping, just announcing, hey, I'm switching my commitment? No, but he did decommit and is going to commit somewhere else. So technically, that's still a flip. There's going to be a TCU theme here, by the way. Andrew Coker, the offensive lineman out of Katy Taylor, he told me 3 weeks ago, roughly, yeah, he is going to visit Texas. Still some interest there. Texas is still talking to him, so he's a guy. If you're looking for a couple wild cards, and I think these are extreme, I don't say extreme, but they're wild cards, but Marcel Brooks, linebacker to Flower Mound Marcus. This is a five-star type talent. Committed to LSU. Texas has kind of been in touch with him. There was talk that he might visit a while back. It never happened. He and Trey Sanders are buddies. So if Trey comes to Texas, could that impact things? But that's a real wild card. Stephen Parker is a defensive lineman out of South Oak Cliff, committed to Texas Tech. That one's interesting because his name's kind of resurfaced. But I was told, I want to say it might have been the USC game, might have even been the Tulsa game. I don't remember which one, to go back and look, that he was going to visit for that game. But I still can't get Stephen Parker to confirm anything. So that's kind of tough sledding. That's a name to file away. But, the names people want to talk about and hear about, and the only ones they're going to care about are DeMarvin Leal out of Converse Judson, guys like Garrett Wilson. But I think those have been overblown by – I mean, I think fans are exaggerating UT's chances. I think, if I'm being honest, I think other recruiting reporters have exaggerated Texas's chances. Everything DeMarvin Leal has said since committing to Texas A&M is how solid he is. He's made repeated visits to College Station. He's recruiting on their behalf. I mean, he's a top priority. Tim Brewster's going to see him whenever he can. So, I just don't see that one happening. Garrett Wilson, if the wheels completely fall off at Ohio State, maybe that's possible, but I'm not expecting it. And if he opens things up, I don't even know if it's Texas. I don't know that it would be UT. I did reach out to Garrett recently, actually just last week, and he's usually very responsive. I mean, incredibly responsive to text messages, and he didn't respond to my text message. So I don't know if that's a case of he just wants to focus on a season, if that's a case of he's getting bombarded by people hitting him up with that same type of question, but it was, I think that might have been the first time ever he didn't respond to my text. So read into that whatever you want. Marcus Banks, defensive back, recently decommitted from LSU. But, I checked around there. Texas really isn't in play much there. There's been some small communication. Banks has said he wants to visit Texas, but that's more his side than Texas at this point. And if we're looking, I tell you what, if you want the most honest answer, who's the most possible flip? I think you got to look at the 2020 class. Damon Demas, the receiver who committed to A&M, potential five-star receiver. This is a young man who's been on campus a couple times, supposed to possibly be back this weekend. That's one of those ones I'll follow up on Friday. We'll see if he actually makes it, or even Saturday morning. But, if you want the most likely, it might be Damon Demas, might be the most likely flip. And I mean, he's 2020, so he doesn't get the spotlight, but he's as good as any player I just talked about. So, those are kind of the names I would be keeping an eye on. There are a couple linemen. Texas obviously needs offensive linemen. Layden Robinson's a center prospect out of Manville. He did tell me Texas had reached out to him, but he's pretty locked in at this point. you know, we always, I keep an eye, a guy like Cole Birmingham who's committed. Could he flip from Oklahoma State? It's possible, but there's not really any movement there. So it's not, it's always a fun topic to talk about, Ketch, but I don't know if there's a real sexy answer right now as to who might immediately flip, certainly in-state prospects from anywhere in-state to the University of Texas. And there's my Debbie Downer update for everybody.
Drunk Rando, did any of those names do anything for you? As someone who would probably love to see some high-profile commitments, did that move the meter at all?
I mean, the one I want is easy. That's the Marvin Lill. I thought back in the spring, I thought he was Texas all the way. And so I just expected him, and losing him hurt, and then losing him to the hated Aggies really, really hurt. But even after that, I thought there was a crack in the door. But
and there was. You got to remember, he took an official visit.
Yeah,
he did take a Texas official visit. So there is. Yeah, but I think the longer it's gone on, you know, and burst your bubble. But obviously there's a crack there. But I just think it's a real long shot to actually win him over. But, hey, man, we're talking teenagers and recruiting. So don't give up all.
If this was college basketball, man, just give that kid a suitcase full of $250,000 and his dad a job. And nothing will ever happen of it, right? Right? Like, isn't that what we've learned?
Not expecting it, but
well, no, I don't know who the bag man is these days.
That's the one I wanted. Another one is just looking at the. I'm just been looking at the Lone Star list, and Marcel Brooks is another one I'd like to have. And a lot of that's just because he's committed to LSU, and I really trust those guys on evaluating defensive players. And I think linebacker and defensive end are both positions of need, which is one of the topics we discussed earlier. So I would just throw those two guys out there, but I'm not really expecting either of those to happen. Just more of a wish list.
And Brooks is a guy everybody, I mean, LSU, you're right, does a great job with their evaluations, but I mean, every you watch his tape, it literally one play, you're like, that guy's a take. I mean, but there's been so many kind of behind the scenes issues that have caused a lot of teams to pull off. You know, Texas has stayed in touch. It was a couple weeks ago, Brian Carrington, he retweeted something. I can't even remember exactly what it was in reference to Marcel Brooks. Well, that's a small sign. I mean, Texas is keeping an eye on him, but yeah, like you, Drunk Rando, I'm not expecting it to happen. Might he show up on campus at some point? Brooks is such a wild card, man. Anything is possible. Honestly, that wouldn't completely floor me, but I think there's a lot of things that would need to work out for an actual flip to happen there. So, but it's certainly one to keep an eye on from a distance. Bo?
Well, guys, I've
yes,
had,
sir.
I've had some.
I'm not the recruiting guy, so I'm gonna stay on the side. What can I say? I mean, I want Garrett Wilson. He looks good, but I mean, I'm not. I don't have an informed opinion. Yeah. I mean, if you want to give me any of the three wide receivers at the top of your ticket, Weiss, Wilson, Henderson, or the big guy Green, I'll take any of them right now. Flip all you want, but to have an informed opinion about how good they are in high school, I haven't seen a high school football game in 5 years, other than a Cedar Park Timberwolves game. I think there's a nose tackle named Josiah Whittington that we need, but you know, that's not my area.
Gotcha. Lil is the guy that I can't believe hasn't been more there. Just, I'm a little bit with Drunk Randoke on that one. He's the guy that if you could poach anybody in the state, he's the guy that you would poach for needs, for talent, for everything else. And that whole recruitment, the way it flipped on a dime and has never flipped back again. That's what I thought. When that kid committed to A&M, I thought, okay, he's going to be the guy this year that goes back and forth and back and forth. And he went back and forth, and he just never went back again, truly. And it's been less back and forth and more just back or forth, whichever direction he would suggest going to College Station ended up being. All right, well, guys, I think we're done. I think we've gone through all four topics on this original Pigskin Plinko podcast. Thanks to Drunk Rando. Thanks to Bo Edge, who you'll soon be hearing here on the Yak as it's the revenge of the Nooner, isn't it, Bo?
That is correct. Revenge of the Nooner with me, Chance Mock, and JD Lewis. If you were a fan of the show back in the day when it was on middays for many years, you'll like it even better now because it'll be unfiltered, uncensored, and it'll be a little different than it was before.
No FEC or FCC.
Both. No FEC.
One
no
day there
FCC,
will be no FEC either. Yes, that's correct. But no FCC. And for Jason Sukumel, whose recruiting podcast will be out on the Yak later today, if I'm not mistaken. Correct, Jason?
It's posted this morning, actually.
Boom. There you go. For all of us, thank you for listening. We'll do this again soon. I thought it was fun. We'll talk to you later. Bye-bye.